Hello and welcome to Truth in Journalism, a radio broadcast dedicated to applying the Word of God to current events. Well, today on Truth in Journalism, we're going to talk about beauty. Our article is by Kate Wagner of The New Republic and is entitled, Dunsing About Architecture, The Ignorance and Racism Behind the Right-Wing Push for Classical Federal Buildings. On February 4th, 2020, the Architectural Record reported that it had obtained a copy of a proposed executive order entitled Making Federal Buildings Beautiful Again. The order would essentially force a rewrite of the 1962 Guiding Principles for Federal Architecture, which mandated that an official architectural style must be avoided for federal buildings and that new buildings should be exemplary of the time in which they are built. The proposition put forth by this new executive order, which is spearheaded by the National Civic Art Society, a conservative nonprofit, would essentially scrap the old guidelines in favor of a mandate that establishes a classical style inspired by Greek and Roman architecture as the default. The American Institute of Architects swiftly published vehement denunciations to this plan on the grounds that it would stifle architecture and violate the free thought and artistic expression that are essential to a democracy. Comparisons have already been made to Mussolini, Hitler, and Stalin. Everyone is very mad online. The abrupt aesthetic reversal heralded by this executive order has some obvious underpinnings, beginning with the fact that the reversion to a mandatory classical style reflects the architectural philosophies of white supremacists online, as well as the doings of a developer president and a right-wing think tank making what is explicitly a political move. But this is also the inevitable result of an architectural faux populism that has been sown in the conscience of American architecture since postmodernism. The effort to stifle aesthetic expression in public architecture by instating a mandatory style is wrong. It would allow Trump to create a President's Committee for the Rebeautification of Federal Architecture, which would enforce this design mandate, and this panel would exclude artists, architects, engineers, art or architectural critics, members of the building industry, or any other members of the public that are affiliated with any interest group or organization involved in architecture. Speaking as an architecture critic, this is insane and borderline totalitarian. But, as with all the insane and borderline totalitarian things Trump does, it can be partially explained by the man himself. Whether we like to admit it or not, Trump is an architectural president. In his professional life and as a failing developer, he has had his grubby, tiny hands in myriad buildings across the country. Like all building peddlers, Trump is subjected to the gaze of architecture critics who have on occasion praised his work, but most often have panned it. Neoclassical architecture isn't always a right-wing dog whistle. The issue of establishing a national style for federal buildings, while also the domain of infamous dictators, has its place in American architectural history. It can be found in the colonial and federal-style buildings constructed during the very founding of the country. The Beaux-Arts-style domination of federal buildings in D.C. in the 19th and 20th centuries, and the widespread uniformity of buildings built during the New Deal under the Works Progress administration. Though, it's worth clarifying that these were not officially encoded in any kind of law or shoehorned through an executive order drafted by nincompoops. During the postmodern period, a faux populist narrative emerged. Modernism was a failure. The now famous Learning from Las Vegas is a nuanced and very funny book, but its message was quickly flattened into modernism is a failure and ordinary people hate modernism. The chairman of the NCAS, Marion Smith, recently said, "For too long, architectural elites and bureaucrats have derided the idea of beauty, blatantly ignored public opinions on style, and have quietly spent taxpayer money constructing ugly, expensive, and inefficient buildings. This executive order gives voice to the 99%, the ordinary American people who do not like what our government has been building." The notion of the architecture of the people, the architecture that people really want, fuels both ads for new suburban developments and the architectural ideologies of the Nazis. Claiming to speak for the aesthetic tastes of the everyman is a trick tucked up the sleeve of both Don Draper and Albert Speer. Most people aren't really thinking about the architecture of McDonald's when they go to the drive-thru, and while most people love taking pictures on the steps of the Capitol building, they also enjoy taking selfies in front of the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Simply put, people love good buildings, modern and traditional. More to the point, architecture is imbued with all manner of personal meaning to people who experience it, regardless of how good it is. Only a specific kind of person looks at architecture and feels the need to talk about the Grecian ideal or the backbone of Western society. That person is either, usually, a white supremacist or a stuck-up nitwit trapped in the 1980s, or, in the case of Trump himself, both. Okay. So, this is a topic that is actually really important to me for several reasons. First, I hate modern architecture. I mean, I hate it. I have a violent emotional response to its deliberate ugliness and cruelty. Modern architecture is, frankly, a grotesque experiment in merging mammon-worshipping capitalism and humanity-hating deconstructionist leftism. Modern architecture is ugly and imposing because it's supposed to be. When you look at the Boston City Hall, by the way, if you've never seen it, look it up online, the Boston City Hall. You say to yourself, "Good heavens, that is one ugly and disconcerting building." And you know what? You're not wrong. It is ugly. It is disconcerting. It's supposed to be. That's what modernist architecture is. It's brutalism. Second, this topic is important to me because not only do I hate modern architecture, I hate the elitist pseudo-intellectual snobbery behind it. In this article by Kate Wagner, she essentially says that we can't trust the population at large to determine what kind of buildings the people at large will pay for with their own money. You can't trust the common man with architecture that he's paying for with his money because architecture is for architects. The architects will tell you what to like. And if you don't like it, well, too bad. The architect already told you. There's something so masturbatory about modern architecture. It's all about the architect expressing his or her almost always deeply depressing and hopeless and nihilistic view of reality on the rest of the world. Unlike an ugly symphony that you can just choose not to hear, or an ugly painting that you can choose not to view, architects build big buildings that people must look at if they live in a city, or worse, if they have to live, work, or conduct business in these horror shows. Who cares if the people actually like being in a place? Who cares if these plebs can stand walking into a building without a little piece of themselves dying? No. Those things don't matter. What matters is that the architect has expressed himself. But the truth is that beauty is a real thing, and real people know that beauty is real, and they have a real physical response to beauty and ugliness. Beauty is real because God is real, and God is beautiful, and all beauty reflects His beauty. Thirdly, the topic of beauty in architecture is important because, like I said, God is beautiful. Christians should care about the beautiful because the beautiful reflects God. Christians should try to make the world more beautiful. Now, you ask, Luke, what is beauty? Well, to give you a theological answer, I would say that beauty is whatever reflects the person of Christ. Now, what does that mean for buildings? What does that mean for architecture? Well, in architecture, it means a combination of the ordered and the natural. There should be natural lines, but also order to it, because God is a God who brings order, but who is also, in his essence, completely other and transcendent and natural. The God who made geometry and fractals is also the God who made the willow tree and the electron cloud. By the way, friends, have you ever noticed how much of our faith is a combination of order and chaos, order and the natural? God asks people to build temples, not to worship in nature. God gives us the sacrament of communion, but is the sacrament of commun is communion eating grain and grapes? No, it's bread and wine. Worship always involves both the natural and the artificial. And by artificial, I mean the old sense of the word, as in it has been made by human artifice, by human endeavor, human effort. Beauty in architecture also means a combination of simplicity and complexity. Architecture should possess unity and diversity. There must be coherence between the parts, but there must be parts. The Godhead is unity and diversity, and humans are multiple layers of unity and diversity. The whole universe is unity and diversity. Good architecture oughtn't to be monolithic. It must reflect the unity and diversity that God possesses. Beauty in architecture also means a combination of motion and permanence. God is both eternal and in time. Through Christ, He is both the Rock of Ages and the Rider on the Clouds. Great architecture contains great beauty, not only of permanence, but of motion. And that's why people love the Taj Mahal and St. Basil's Cathedral. They are enormous, but they also look like they're moving. Those beautiful spires and minarets, those onion-shaped domes, they have permanence and motion. Baroque architecture tries to get at this too. The Rococo designs that were so popular in that era, the Baroque era, it also is there. It's trying to give permanence and motion. Now, we could continue talking about concepts of beauty and how they derive from who God is, but the simple fact of the matter is that the more things conform to the image of God, the more beautiful they truly are. God is beautiful. And I believe part of our job as Christians is to make the world more beautiful. Too often, evangelical Christians have had the idea that, well, it's all going to burn anyway, so why waste time on building buildings that'll be gone? Let's focus on eternal things. And there is some truth to this. There is some good Christian logic to this. But the logic falls on its face when it's confronted with who God actually is. The fact of the matter is that for basically all of church history until the Calvinist Reformation, people sought to beautify their world and their places of worship because they saw beautifying the world as a means of glorifying God and worshiping Him. Friends, have you ever stopped to consider that God gave Adam and Eve the command to make the whole world into a garden? God's task was not for all of humanity to stay in Eden, but for humanity to make the world Eden. We were supposed to subdue the earth. We were supposed to take the wildness of nature and harness that and order it to make the jungle into a garden, to make ponds and rivers into water parks, to make mountains into hiking trails and ski resorts. God wanted us to beautify the world because by beautifying the world, we would stamp God's likeness on the world, and in so doing, we would become more like Him. Couldn't God have made the whole world a garden Himself? Of course, but God in His incomprehensible goodness wants us to participate in His plan to make the whole universe Eden. Jesus could have fed the 5,000 without bread. He could have just said the word and filled their tummies. But instead, He chose to use a kid's sack lunch and let the disciples participate. Oh, friends, beauty isn't about glorifying God only. It's about participating in His beauty and beautifying ourselves in the process. When a person glorifies God, they glorify themselves because the act of worship makes us more like God, who exists in eternal glorification of the other persons of the Trinity. Brothers and sisters, we are never more like God than when we worship. We never gain more glory for ourselves than when we glorify God. We are never more beautiful than when we are spreading the beauty of Christ over His creation. So, of course, there is this obvious implication. What about the architecture that Christians build? What about our churches and chapels? Does beauty matter for churches? I believe it does. I believe that architecture communicates to us in a deep and more often than not unconscious way. The places we worship all affect us. The light, the lines, the acoustics, the decoration, the layout of people, their proximity, the airspace, the focus of vision, all these things communicate unconsciously but clearly what things have value and what things are acceptable. It's hard to imagine a praise band in St. Paul's Cathedral, and it's equally incongruous to imagine performing Handel in a storefront church. You see, friends, despite what we may have learned unintentionally or intentionally, our bodies matter. Our bodies affect our souls just as much as our souls affect our bodies. So when we kneel to pray, that affects us in a way that sitting to pray doesn't. When our churches look like shopping malls, it reinforces the conception of consumerism upon the worshiper. The worshiper comes to church to shop for happiness and fulfillment rather than to worship the Creator of the universe and be prepared to love and serve Him. Brothers and sisters, we need to recognize that architecture and design really do matter, and they really do affect how we worship, and they really do affect the kind of Christians we'll become. So, in an act of monumental stupidity, which I'm sure is going to make everybody mad at me, I'm going to make a few suggestions on how better architecture will allow us to better worship and have better spiritual formation. So, prepare to be dazzled and also enraged. First, beauty does matter. Build a beautiful space and not just an economical one. Yes, I get that there are Christians who are starving. I think that we have enough wealth in this country to feed the starving and not have hideous church buildings that look indistinguishable from an IKEA or a movie theater. When we simply attempt to make the cheapest building possible, we are essentially saying that worshiping Christ is not worth the money. If you have a beautiful home, then build a beautiful church. Second, stop designing sanctuaries like theaters. Churches should focus on a small point. The focus of the eye should be on the altar, the pulpit, and the baptistry. When the eye has to spread out and has no focus, it communicates that nothing has highest value. The stage says that worship is a performance to be observed and not an act in which to participate. Third, pews are comfortable, communal, and family-friendly. Chairs feel impermanent, are uncomfortable, and they tell you that you need to simply sit there and observe. Fourth, trendiness is dumb. Stop trying to be trendy. Trendiness says that the church is trying to change itself to please others, not to become a transformative space in its own right. Lastly, light is good. Stop building movie theaters. Stop building churches without windows. Stop building buildings that let in no natural light, that are dark and depressing. Windows are good. And stained glass subconsciously communicates that the divine transforms the natural. Okay. Now, I've given these 5 points that I think will allow us to build better churches. Build beautiful buildings, stop designing sanctuaries like theaters, use pews and not chairs, stop trying to be trendy, and allow light to come in, natural light to come in. So, now that I've made everybody mad, I want to say that beauty matters. Beauty matters because beauty reflects the beauty of God. And as Christians, we should care about beauty, and we should care about beauty in architecture. So, let's participate in God's beauty by building beautiful buildings to worship our beautiful God in. I hope and pray we will, and I hope you'll join us again next week for another exciting episode of Truth and journalism. Thank you, and may God bless your day to His glory.